Okay, everyone. So, let's start. And, okay, tonight I'm going to talk about the Buddhist attitude to sensuality, to sensual pleasures. As always, what is one of the interesting things about the Buddhist teachings is it always has a slightly different take on things than most of the rest of the world. And so it is also with sensuality and sensual pleasures. And it is an important part of the Buddhist path to understand these things. And for that reason, I think it is interesting at least to have a kind of broader understanding how it fits in on the path and how it kind of all is integrated into the idea that we call Buddhist practice. But first of all, what do we mean by sensual pleasures in Buddhism? And what we mean is, of course, the idea of desire. And when we talk about desire, we talk about desire in Buddhism for everything concerned with the five senses. Yeah, anything you see, anything you hear, anything you taste, anything you touch, or even anything you smell in this world. That is kind of the world of sensuality. Yeah, so you can start to see pretty much straight away, if that is the world of sensuality, well, that's pretty much all there is almost. Yeah, that's kind of, our world is bombarded by the five senses throughout the day, for week after week, year after year, usually for the whole lifetime. And only occasionally do we escape that world a little bit, maybe through meditation practice or whatever. But basically, that is the life we live, a sensual life, engulfed in the sensual objects, and of course then the desire and aversions that arise from that. So even at night, yeah, you dream something, and still, in a sense, you are enmeshed in the world of sensuality. Why is that? Because your dreams and all of these things, they are also often about such things. So it's a very vast and very all-encompassing part of our life. How do we think about it? How does the Buddha think about this? I always want to come back to the word of the Buddha. What does the Buddha say should be our attitude towards these things? That is what I want to talk about tonight. The first way in which Buddhism is different from the rest of the world in thinking about sensuality is that Buddhism doesn't really have a puritanical kind of strain to it. Buddhism doesn't say that sensuality is bad just because it's bad. Buddhism doesn't say that enjoying ourselves in the world and having relationships, entertainment, eating nice food, all of that stuff is not bad from a Buddhist point of view. So Buddhism lacks some of this puritanical strength that you can sometimes find elsewhere in our society. That is already quite a liberating thing. Enjoying oneself is okay. There's one interesting passage in the... I just thought about this beforehand, there's an interesting passage in the Pali Canon. This is the Pali Canon, is the word of the Buddha. And the word of the Buddha says to the monks, you know, some of the monks may not be practicing properly or they're not fully getting into the meditation or whatever. And he says to them, you know, you guys are missing out. You're missing out on the happiness of the monastic life. Happiness of monastic life, what is that? It's kind of meditating, being peaceful inside, getting some of the joy and happiness that comes from meditation practice. If you don't get that happiness, you're not getting the happiness of the monastic life, and you're also missing out on the happiness of lay life. So it's almost, I don't think this is the point. The point is not that you better disrobe and get back into lay life. I don't think that's the point. But the point is that as human beings, we desire happiness or pleasures in one way or another, whether that is the kind of pleasures of the senses or the pleasures of the mind and meditation, doesn't really matter. But we always, life without pleasure is a meaningless life. So this is the first thing. So, Buddhism is not anti-pleasure or anti-happiness or anti-enjoyment. And I think this is a very important point to keep in mind, because sometimes you can maybe get that idea from certain ways in which the Buddhist teachings are taught. So this is the one side of the coin. But the other side of the coin is that the Buddha also said that there can be certain dangers with sensual pleasures. And so what are those dangers? If we shouldn't be afraid of them, how come there are dangers as well? Then, of course, one of the dangers, one of the main points of the Buddhist teachings is to live well. To live with kindness and compassion. And of course, the moment that those sensual pleasures take us beyond the boundaries of morality, when we start misbehaving, maybe stealing or committing adultery or whatever else it is, once we get down that avenue, that is when we have taken the sensual indulgence too far. So we indulge, or we, maybe I shouldn't say indulge, but we enjoy the sensual pleasures within the bounds of morality. Yeah, this is kind of the Buddhist attitude. So we don't hurt other people. We don't hurt other beings. And when we don't do that, then it is an acceptable way of enjoying the world around us. That is the first thing. I think that's pretty obvious. You probably all know that already, unless you are your first time here maybe tonight, because this is kind of 101 Buddhism. Yeah. But then, the other reason why sensuality is problematic, and now we're getting to the kind of deeper reasons. And one of the main reasons is because sensuality is, to some extent, opposed to meditation practice. Yeah, if you really want to go really, really deep in your meditation, if you don't just come here on Friday night, I mean, it's wonderful to come here on Friday night, relax a little bit, just enjoy the good company, and just have a good time. I think that is a wonderful thing already. But if you want to take the meditation a little bit deeper than that, say you come out to Jhana Grove in a 9-day retreat with Ajahn Brahm or something else, or you go to some other retreat center or whatever it is, if you want to take it deeper, the deeper you want to take it, the more of an obstacle the sensual and desires and the sensual indulgence of the world actually becomes. There's like a trade-off in a sense. The more you let go of the sensual world, the deeper profound your meditation becomes. The more you attach to the sensual world, the more kind of shallow your meditation is. It's almost like an inversely proportional relationship, just to use my old mathematics from university days. Yeah, inversely proportional relationship. Sounds very mathematical. Sounds like we should have some of these mathematical concepts in Buddhist books to kind of make it really clear what is going on, I reckon. So this is why it is problematic. Why does it have to be like that? Very often you hear people saying that, I want to enjoy the world and I also want to enjoy meditation. I don't want to give up one to have the other one. I want to enjoy both. So, what's the point of becoming a monk, for example, or nun? Because that's really nuts. You can't enjoy the ordinary life. But the point is that you cannot enjoy both fully. There's always a trade-off between the two. And this is the thing that I think a lot of people in the Buddhist world, perhaps especially in the West, because people are still kind of fairly new to Buddhism, we don't really grasp what these concepts are. So to understand that, you actually have to, you have to actually see or read some of the discourse of the Buddha to see that this actually is the case. And when you think about it, it is actually very obvious. I was going to say blooming obvious, but that's kind of bad. It's very obvious. Why is it so obvious? Because especially if you indulge in sensual pleasures, if you enjoy that too much, what happens is that you attach to the sensuality. Attachment is always just behind indulgence and enjoyment. If you enjoy it a lot, you want it again. That is attachment. You want to be there. You want to be able to see because, wow, so many beautiful sights. You want to be able to hear because the music that you listen to is so beautiful. And maybe it is. I'm not saying it isn't. But you attach to that. Or you want to enjoy your relationships or your food or whatever it is. And all of that, because we indulge in it, we attach to it. And when you attach to it, when you try to meditate, you can't let go. Letting go is precisely the exact opposite of indulgence. You go inwards. And the more inwards you want to go, the more you have to let go of the five senses and the sensual world. If you hold on to the senses, you can only go so far inside. The less you hold on to the senses, the deeper you can go inside. So this is why there is a problem there, and this is why there is like a trade-off between the sensual world and the deep meditation. So sensuality is not immoral. It is not bad. It is not evil, as long as you do it in a moral way. But it can lead to a blockage in your meditation practice, and that is why it is problematic. I'm sure you can see what I'm talking about here, how always going outside is the opposite of going inside. If you attach to external things, you cannot let go and go inside as a consequence. There's a trade-off there. So once you understand that, you start to understand why there is such a thing as monastic life. This is precisely why, because monastic life is a trying to enhance that process of letting go of external things while moving more inwards. That is what this whole thing is about. That is why there is such a thing as monastic life. These things are far harder to do in lay life than they are in monastic life, and that is why we live in this way. It's not because we are world-denying, boring kind of people sitting in the forest crying by ourselves because it's such a terrible thing to be a monastic. That's not really the point. The point is it's actually different. It's not like we're not kind of masochists or anything like that. There is another point to this whole thing here. So this is the reason. And then there is this is actually a very important reason, I think. If you really want to enjoy your meditation, some degree of letting go is actually necessary. And I'm sure you can see that already to some extent, even just by coming here on Friday nights. But there is a third reason why sensuality is problematic. And now we come into the really deep parts of the Buddhist teachings. Yeah, and in a deeper sense, sensuality is the bond that ties us to samsara. That is why it is really problematic. Samsara is this Pali word which means like the round of existence. Yeah, you carry on, you get born here, you die there, rebirth and re-death. Have you heard about the word re-death before? Re-death is a really good word, yeah? Because you don't get die only once, you die many times. If you get reborn, you get to have to re-die as well. I think we should implement this word re-death in the Buddhist teaching, because it really gets to the point of what this is about. So, rebirth, re-death, re-life, re-everything. Yeah? That's kind of part of the problem here. Yeah? So if you don't want all this re, we can just kind of shorten it down to re, yeah, that kind of makes it very simple. If you know all this re stuff all the time, there comes a point when you start to realize actually the bondage to samsaric existence, that is the real problem. And the most powerful, the strongest of all those bonds is the bond of sensuality. It ties you to samsara. Why? Because sensuality is always about the future. It's about craving. It's about moving somewhere else. Always moving towards something. Never really being satisfied in the present moment. And that moving towards something is like a projection of yourself into the future. That is why it ties you eternally. Hopefully not eternally. But for a long time into the future, again and again and again. So these are some of the reasons. You can see here, again, the balance of Buddhism. Yeah, the balance of seeing the problem with something, seeing the gratification and the problem, and then finding a kind of middle way. So many things in the Buddhist teachings are about a middle way, and so it is also with sensuality. So it's a natural path whereby your meditation deepens. You naturally and let go of things that actually are less important to you. Sensuality becomes less important. Meditation becomes more important. You don't force it. You don't push it aside. It happens quite naturally. This is the beautiful part, the beautiful path that you see right there. So if there is a problem with sensuality, if you are really keen on your spiritual path. I don't know how keen you are. Everyone here, probably various degrees. But don't leave just because you're not 100% keen, because still might be interesting to see what's happening next. Yeah, I promise to. For me, anyway, it's very interesting. It's very hard for me to understand why other people won't find it interesting. That's my own limitation, really. I think some of these things actually are. It's a big picture view of life and the world, and this is why it is interesting here. So how can we deal with these things in such a way to move a little bit away from sensuality and a little bit more towards spiritual happiness and meditation and depth of meditation? How can we actually do that in a way that is easy, natural, and not kind of forced or anything like that? And the first thing, one of the things that I always found very interesting in the suttas, when it talks about overcoming the defilements and the problems of the mind. The defilements and the problems, usually you can summarize them in two main defilements. One being ill will, including anger and upset and all that kind of stuff. And the other one being desire. These are the two kind of main defilements that we tend to deal with. And of course, dealing with ill will is actually the most important one. If I'm going to really recommend you to deal with one thing in your life, of your mental phenomena that are problematic, ill will is number one. Please, if you are serious about this path, see if you can do something about that. I may give a talk here again about how to deal with ill will, because I think it's such an incredibly important part of the path. And surprisingly, you may think that it's hard to get rid of ill will. It isn't that hard, actually, especially if you have the right motivation, the right kind of perseverance. Everyone can get rid of ill will, at least to a large extent, maybe not 100%, but at least a lot of it. So that is ill will, so focus on that. But sensuality also, yeah, is a little bit of a problem. So that's what I want to focus on now. So how does the Buddha say we should deal with these things? What is kind of the method? And very often people think that you deal with these things through meditation practice, by sitting here and becoming peaceful and calm. And that is certainly part of it. But really, one of the remarkable things I remember reading in the suttas, when the Buddha says that there is these two powers in your meditation, or two powers on the spiritual path. And the first power is the power of reflection. Yeah? What does the power of reflection do? And the Buddha says the power of reflection, what it does, it overcomes the misconduct by body, speech and mind, and it allows you to have good conduct by body, speech and mind. Yeah, in other words, all your ability to practice morality by body and speech, and also your ability to think in a way that is not destructive for your meditation, including getting rid of ill will and sensuality, it's all about how we reflect about the world, how we think about things. Yeah, it is not just about sitting back and enjoying the peace. That is a little bit of it, but mainly it's about how we think about things. So very interesting. What that means is that if we learn to think in the right way, we can actually overcome these problems. So this is what I want to do tonight. I want to kind of look a bit more. How can we think about these things in such a way that these things actually are reduced? And then when you have that power of reflection, then comes the second power, which is the bhavana bala. Do you like Pali words? Yeah, does that sound cool, good to you? Cool. I like Pali words, but I always find it very nice to come back to the Pali, because I love reading the suttas, the word of the Buddha. Bhavana bala means the power of meditation or the power of development. I think in Sinhalese, bhavana is actually used specifically to refer to meditation practice. In large part, that's true also of the suttas. That meditation, power of meditation, is to develop the really deep samadhis on the path, the four jhanas, the seven factors of awakening, and these kind of things. Yeah, so the very deep meditation practice that is about. It doesn't, not so much about overcoming defilements, but to go really deep in your meditation. Remember that. Learn to think in the right way. As you think in the right way, your life starts to change. The way you think about people, the way you reflect on things, the way you perceive reality around you is actually different because you are reflecting in the right way. Huh? So how do we do this? And what I'm going to do, and this is my kind of standard way of talking about sensual pleasures, and many of you will have heard about it before, but please don't leave because of that, because these are things that are eternally important and wonderful to hear about in many, many times, in my opinion. I have heard it more than any one of you, and I still get inspired by some of these teachings. To make the point clear, what the Buddha does, he gives a number of similes that refer directly to sensual pleasures. Yeah, and I'm going to recount some of these similes for you. And then remember similes and these little stories that Buddha uses. These are tools of reflection, tools for how to think about the world. Not tools for forcing you one way or another one, but for natural reflection and then maturing of the mind as a consequence of these reflections. So the first simile that the Buddha uses, I cannot the first one, one of the similes that he uses is what is called the simile of the grass torch, the burning grass torch. So the Buddha says that imagine someone coming along and they have a grass torch, and they have a grass torch which is burning, and then they go against the wind. Yeah, the wind coming in the other direction, the grass torch coming in front of you. What happens when that happens? Well, a grass torch, of course, has all the cinders and all the, the burning things coming off it all the time. That's what a grass torch is like. So if you go against the wind, all the things, all the cinders will kind of hit you. Yeah, and soon enough, you will be on fire if you're not very careful. And if you are on fire, that's usually considered painful in Buddhism. That's dukkha, suffering here. So you don't really, you want to avoid getting on fire. This is kind of the simile here. So what does this mean? How is this a simile for sensual pleasures of the world? And the way this works is that when you grab onto that grass torch, you are attaching it to the sensual objects and the sensual pleasures of the world. Yeah, you start taking up a relationship, or you're taking up certain kind of entertainment or whatever it is, and you grasp onto that. Your life revolves around those things. And as you attach to those things of the world, because you're attaching to them, there's a little bit of light from that glass torch. And that light you get from the glass torch, that is like the happiness that comes from the sensual pleasures. But soon enough, the grass, the happiness that comes from the light, it turns into suffering because you're going against the wind. What is that suffering? And that suffering is that as soon as we attach to things in the world, we are essentially asking for suffering. Why? Because all the things in the world, worldly things, are inherently impermanent, always subject to change, out of our control, unreliable, fundamentally unreliable. And if you try to grasp onto and attach to something that is by nature unreliable, by nature impermanent, what's going to happen? You're going to suffer. Yeah? It's kind of a very basic Buddhist idea. If things are impermanent, suffering must happen as a consequence. So think about it. This really is really problematic. And sometimes people say, well, if I'm going to be a good Buddhist, what I should do then is just to avoid attachments. Yeah, so you can try that and see how that works in your life. Try to avoid all attachments. And the answer is, it is impossible to avoid all attachments. Maybe if you're an arahant, and usually at this point I'd like to ask how many arahants in the assembly, and usually what you find, not that many, not many in the assembly. So that is the problem, because you're not an arahant, you are going to attach. Why? Because all of this comes from the sense of self. When there is a perception of a self inside that is permanent, that is always there, that sense of self will take certain things in the world to belong to it. These are my things. This is my realm of control, if you like. The sense of self believes it can control the world. It forgets about the impermanence of things. And it kind of projects that sense of self outwards to all these other things as well. And then because we think we can control, we try to control, but we can't. The world always goes according to its own cause and conditions. And our ability to control things is actually supremely limited. And then things fall apart. And then we grieve, we cry, we feel despair because things aren't going according to plan, how we wanted them to go. And it's because we haven't really understood the Buddhist idea of impermanence, of unreliability. But take that on board. If you take that on board, you don't grasp so strongly on that grass torch anymore. You realize the grass torch is inherently problematic. You're going to burn. And if you burn up, then of course after a while you're going to die. That's what happens when you burn, and then it's really problematic for you. So you grasp a little bit more lightly. You seek for your happiness and satisfaction in the world in slightly different places. Not so much in those places where you have to grasp and attach so strongly. Simile of the grass torch. One of the most basic and fundamental similes for the problem of the sensual world. If you go inside, it is slightly different because you don't grasp so strongly onto the internal states of the mind. It's a much lighter touch that you have with those things. Simile number two. This is a simile of the Buddha where he talks about it's about birds, and this is this bird that has got hold of a piece of meat. And of course, if a bird gets hold of this meat, very happy bird. So the bird takes off, holds the piece of meat in its little claws, and flies off. But of course, there are many other birds who also would like a piece of meat. You don't get left alone if you are a bird holding a piece of meat. Other birds want it too. So as soon as it flies off, these other birds also take off, follow that bird, grab hold of it, try to rip out the piece of meat from its claws. And the Buddha says, well, if that bird doesn't give up that piece of meat quickly, what's going to happen to that bird? Well, it will either suffer or it will die because it will have to fight with these other birds. And that is the consequence of grabbing hold of that piece of meat. And as you can understand, the piece of meat, of course, is here a simile for the sensual pleasures or the sensual objects of the world. Yeah, because we grab onto those sensual objects. The problem is that the world is such that other people also want those sensual objects. Yeah, as soon as you find some wonderful person to share your life with, yeah, and kind of thinking about having a partnership, you find out other people too are interested in that person. Yeah, problematic. And even if you actually have a nice partnership and you find somebody to live with, then of course you are eternally slightly worried that that person might leave you. Maybe they will find someone else. Yeah, there's always some underlying concern there because you never know. This is kind of the fighting over the piece of meat almost. Yeah, we're fighting over things in the world. And the world is full of that. So much of how we live our life and how the world works is this fight over limited resources. Everybody wants more. Nobody's ever quite satisfied. There's no kind of end point in terms of craving. And because there's no end point for all of us, we fight over limited resources, always wanting more, always wanting to go somewhere else. There's a beautiful story that in the, this is in a sutta called the Ratapala Sutta, a very nice sutta that I would recommend you all to read if you have the chance. It's of a young man from a very wealthy family, and he goes forth in the time of the Buddha, and he has kind of got everything in life, yeah? And then he kind of goes forth, his parents try to hold him back. I'm not going to tell the whole story, it's a long story, it's a very kind of nice one, quite funny and entertaining as well. This is the nice thing about the Buddhist teachings. It's both a little bit entertaining and profound at the same time. It's a beautiful combination. Anyway, so he goes forth, yeah, against his parents, which the parents are really opposed to it. He goes forth, and then he becomes an arahant. When he becomes back after an arahant, his parents try to lure him back into lay life. Come get all this gold and stuff. And he can't. He's an arahant. He's a full enlightened. He's not interested in gold and that kind of things anymore. So he kind of dismisses his parents. He calls his father householder. That's one of the things I remember from there. He says householder to his father. And I have never tried to say that to my own father because I think it might go down really badly if I said that. Householder. Oh, okay. But so then he realizes that, you know, his parents kind of give up on him, and he goes off into the forest. He goes into the forest, and then the local king comes out to see him. Yeah, and the king comes out, and then the king is very old at this point, and he asks Ratapala, you have got everything, for goodness sake. You have got a good education, you come from a good family, you are wealthy, you have friends, you have everything in life. Why on earth did you go forth? Are you nuts? No, he didn't say that. I made that up. That's not part of the sutta. I'm adding a little bit for effect. Yeah, and so because he's much too respectful to ask a question like that. But he says, you know, why did you go forth? It's because of, you know, what is the reason? And then Ratapala tells him, well, because I understood these four principles of Dhamma. Yeah, and one of these principles is that the world is a slave to craving. The world is insatiate, a slave to craving. Yeah, you are not in charge. This is the reason why we like desire sometimes, because we think we are in charge. The desire is mine. I will use desire as my tool to get things. No, it's the exact opposite. Again, the Buddha turns the world around 180 degrees. It's the opposite. You are the slave. Craving is in charge. You are saying, yes, master, lead me wherever you want to go. And you follow after your master. Craving is your master. Can you see that? The reason you can't see it is because you have a sense of self that tells you that you are in charge and you are doing these things. But actually that is false. What is true is craving is in charge and you are following along like this silly dog on a leash or something like that. Yeah, going this way, going that way. Yes, master, where would you want to go next? Yeah, that's craving for you. And it's terrible when you think about it. So then this is what Ratapala says to the king. And the king says, I don't understand. What are you talking about? And Ratapala says, well, your majesty, imagine that there was a man. Yeah, you are already wealthy. You have this enormous kingdom. Yeah, you have gold and silver piled up in massive storehouses. You have grain. You have everything in this large kingdom of yours. But imagine that a man came from the west. And this man in the west said, well, to the west of your kingdom, there is another kingdom. Yeah. Full of gold, full of silver, full of treasure, full of all kind of elephants and horses and all this kind of stuff. Elephants and horses and cattle was kind of very much part of what was considered wealth in those days. Yeah, but even though this kingdom to the west has all these things, its army is weaker than yours. Yeah, if you wish you could conquer that country, what would you do, Your Majesty? And the king replies, "Oh, we would conquer it, of course." Yeah, and as if it's absolutely obvious that you conquer a country if you can. Then he says, "Well, what if there was another man coming from the north and said exactly the same thing? What would you do? Oh, we would conquer that country as well. What if it was another one coming from the east? Conquer that one too. From the south, conquer that one too. From overseas, we'll conquer that one too. Is there any kingdom you would not conquer?" Again, that question is not there, but that kind of is implied. Of course not. We'll conquer any kingdom that is there. If it's weaker than mine, we will conquer it. So where does desire end? It doesn't end. Yeah, it just expands. And once you get the whole earth, you cannot set your sights on Mars and Venus probably, because you're not satisfied yet. And then the next solar system, and then the next galaxy. And I reckon the reason why all of these physicists had this idea of the multiverse. Have you heard about the multiverse? This idea in astronomy that there's not only one universe, but there's many universes. I think they realize that when craving comes, the entire universe is yours. Well, where's craving going to go? Okay, we better build, make up a multiverse. Then there's more chance for satisfying our craving. That's where I think that multiverse idea came from. Kind of some sort of subconscious drive of craving that kind of brought forth the idea of the multiverse. That's a very heretical idea. Don't tell that to any astronomers. They will kind of tell you that I'm a fool, an idiot. I don't understand astronomy and physics, of course. But it kind of makes sense, though, doesn't it? Because craving knows no bounds. There is no limit. It just keeps on going and going and going. Yeah. And this is the problem. So this is the thing here, yeah, and this is why there is never enough to satisfy everyone. This is why we have the craving, the desire, is one of the reasons why we have the Royal Banking Commission in Australia right now, because people are just greedy, yeah, and there's not enough. And then you fight, you have office full of politics, and people fighting in the office, trying to put down the others and make themselves look glorious, so they will kind of get the promotion or the bonus or whatever it is. And this is the problem with these things, is fighting over things, always trying to get ahead, and then having lots of casualties, of course, on the way. So this is, to me, a very problematic part with sensuality. Sensuality is inherently full of conflict. Inherently, it leads to violence. Inherently, it leads to wars and all kind of problems. Yeah. And you can see why that has to be the case, because there is never enough for everyone, because craving knows no limits, and we want the same kind of things, and then we ultimately will fight over it. Fight over the inheritance, fight over the promotion at work, fight over the last piece of cake if you are little children, fight over a toy, whatever it is. There's always the world of sensuality tends to lead towards conflict and violence. Think about that. That is very off-putting in a way. Yeah, you cannot really have a peaceful world as long as sensuality is involved. So that is the second simile of the Buddha, and I think a very, very powerful one. The third simile of the Buddha, it's not his third one, but it is a simile anyway. It's the third one in this talk, and that is the simile of the dream. Yeah, the Buddha says that sensual pleasures are like a dream. Yes, we talk about the world not being real sometimes, being like an illusion, being like a projection of the mind, illusory. And sensuality, sensual pleasures are just like that. And if you think about it again, it's fairly obvious why this is the case. These similes are very easy, I think, to understand. Why is it? Because how come it is a dream? And the reason it is a dream is because the way we think about things, the way we think about possessions, the way we think about when I get this new house, when I get this car, when I get this relationship, whatever, the idea in our mind is very different from the reality. Yeah, we know that, especially from relationships, when you kind of fall in love, yeah, and you have this kind of idea of the perfect partner in life. Yeah, and it's kind of, you can't even see any negative aspects in them because you are so biased. You are so, you only see one side of your partner. But the reality, of course, is much broader. So the reality turns out to be very, very different from the fantasy. That is also true in smaller things in life. Yeah, you get the new car, and you have all these dreams about this car. for some people, maybe not everyone, but some people have these kind of fantasies. And the reality, after driving it for a few weeks, it gets pretty ordinary again. And the fantasy recurs, it builds up again. And I remember myself, when I was young, it's a while ago now, but I've been young as well. So when I was at university, for example, which is about 30 years ago now or more, I remember thinking about my own future. And I thought, gee, I'm going to have a really good job. I'm going to make lots of money. I'm going to do all these kind of cool things. I'm going to have a wife like this and this, that kind of wife. And I'm going to kind of do, live well. Going to have, everything's going to be nice. Have the right kind of friends and the kind of stuff. Actually, it wasn't exactly like that, but I'm just kind of making something up. It was a little bit like that. The dream about the future, especially the dream about, girlfriend and wife and that sort of stuff. And having a nice house. And you can see what waste of time that was, When you look at this, it was an absolute mistake. Talking about the dream being wrong, this is kind of maxing out on wrongness. Absolutely wrong. But the reality is that for every one of us, it is a little bit like that. You dream about something, you have this idea of what something is going to be like, and the reality is always different. Life is like a dream, moving towards something that never actually arises. And then when you get those things and you realize the dream isn't going to work out, you're thinking about new things. You change your dream a little bit, but it's still a dream. You never actually get there. We live in this life of wanting to bring something about. We live a dream life that never actually comes out to be quite like that. So much of life is like that. And this is one of the reasons why mindfulness is so difficult. Because if you live a dream, if you live craving, if you live desire, the mind is always onto something else, never really happy to be in the present moment. So as you let go of those things, mind settles into the present moment much more. That is the simile of the dream. Another of my really favorite similes from the suttas is a simile of the borrowed goods. This is the Buddha when he talks about, he says that imagine a rich person. In those days, rich persons were pretty humble compared to what they are these days. A rich person, an ordinary person who borrows goods of rich people. So he gets a nice carriage and he has some nice jewelry, like some nice earrings or whatever. And that's what he considered a rich person in those days, a nice carriage and some earrings. And then he drives around in his carriage and wearing his nice earrings, and drives around in town. it's very humble. Anyway, he drives around town and then people look at him. Wow, check out this rich guy. He's really wealthy. This is how the wealthy enjoy their wealth. This is what they say about this man. And of course, when people point to you and say, you are wealthy, you start inflating your ego straight away. You feel, I'm important, that's right. I'm rich. You guys, you are less than me. I am more, because I'm more wealthy than you are. And this is what happens. If you are wealthy, you start to feel more important. It's just part and part. It's nothing. It's unfortunate, but it's just the reality of human beings. We are like that. It's just the reality of things. And of course, then, because these things are borrowed, then the owner comes back, takes back the carriage, takes back those earrings, and then how does he feel? He feels naked. He feels like that attachment he has built up to those things, his sense of identity, which now is vested in those goods, suddenly is taken away. You feel naked. You feel something is gone. You feel, what? I'm not wealthy after all. It's like you are shocked. You forgot that those goods actually were borrowed. That is the problem. And the reality of our life is that our life is full of borrowed goods. What is borrowed in life? And if you think about it, pretty much everything we have in this life is actually borrowed. Everything you own in your life, your relationships, your friendships in this world, your physical body ultimately is borrowed as well. Why is it borrowed? Because very often nature comes, impermanent comes, unreliability comes and snatches it back, and there's nothing you can do to control it or to hold on to it. At the very latest, when you die, it's going to be taken away from you. Everything in our life, pretty much, especially everything in the sensual world, are borrowed goods. You can't hold on to them. It's going to have to go. What does this mean? And this is actually it's very powerful. If you think about in this life, if you borrow something, if you rent something, like you rent an apartment for a few months, how much investment are you going to put into an apartment that you're renting from someone else? Not that much, because you won't be able to enjoy that investment. The owner will enjoy it rather than you. So if everything in your life is borrowed goods, it means you start investing less in those borrowed goods in your life. And you start investing instead in those things that actually go beyond that, that are more profound, that have a deeper sense of meaning and fulfillment. What is that? And the difference, of course, is that the difference here is between focusing solely on this little existence, this little slice of existence that we have here and now, and to compare that to the existence that you have from a Buddhist point of view, the vast existence takes into account past lives and future lives. It's a panorama far, far wider than the little reality we are aware of right now in this life. And this is why the idea of rebirth, the idea of re-existence, of re-death, of re-everything is so important, because it changes your calculation of what is how we should live, what is important in our lives. What is the thing that is not borrowed goods in the sense? The thing that is not borrowed goods is your mind. Why? Because your mind is what goes beyond this ordinary life and you take with you into your future. If you build up a beautiful mind in this life, if you build up a light mind full of good merit and happiness and good qualities, that is what you take with you into the future. And don't be fooled. It can be done. You can change. You can become more bright. You can become more happy. It's a gradual process. It takes perseverance and commitment, but it can be done. How do we do it? And the way we do it is by not by focusing so much on the results and the goals of this life, but focusing more on the process, focusing more on how we get to these things rather than actually the goals themselves. And I think this is one of those, again, critical things and critical differences in life. The vast majority of people, because we are interested in the sensual realm, the sensual things, we always want to enhance the sensual pleasures in life. We focus on those goals, how to get there. And very often the problem is that the goal justifies the means. The end justifies the means. Yeah, it's one of those kind of ancient sayings, which is complete nonsense, of course, from a Buddhist point of view, because we want to get to those goals. Then whatever means we use to get there is irrelevant. Of course, the problem with that is that you may be building up a lot in this life. You make this life very beautiful, and you have all kind of things in this life. But as part and parcel of that, you take all sorts of shortcuts. You do bad things to other people. When you come to the end of your life, imagine how you feel. You come to the end of your life, you have built up all of these things, and all of these things that you have built up, they belong to this world. They are borrowed goods. Now you're going to have to let go of all of that. And in the meantime, you have done many bad things to drag your mind down, make your mind a bit darker, a bit more unpleasant, a bit a heavier place to be. That is all that you have left when you die. How do you feel? You feel like you have wasted an opportunity. You feel that there's nothing left. You feel that there's a kind of sense of emptiness and confusion. I have wasted the opportunity. I have lived a life focusing solely on things that belong to this world, and there's nothing I can take with me except for the badness I have done in the meantime that has let me down, and the future now is looking very dismal. This is the problem, yeah, by focusing on these things. So instead of focusing on the goal, instead of focusing on the end, a Buddhist way of thinking is to focus on the process, focus on the how we reach those goals, how we get there. And then if the goals don't happen, if we don't achieve those things that we would like to achieve in life, it doesn't matter so much, because by focusing on the process, we have lifted ourselves up, made ourselves a brighter mind, and we feel when we come to the end of our life, okay, I may not have achieved very much in this life, but who cares? It's all going to have to go anyway. The only thing I have achieved is building up a brighter and happier mind for myself. And lo and behold, at this point, that is the only thing that matters. Everything else is irrelevant. So it changes your calculation, the simile of the borrowed goods. It makes you look at life in an entirely different way. And this is such a powerful and wonderful thing. All those people, you know, who you see having taken shortcuts, you know, perhaps some of the things that have been uncovered by the, you know, Royal Banking Commission, all this kind of stuff. Why have they done that? They have focused on the goal, not focusing on the process. And by doing so, they tricked themselves. They made a mistake, and they create badness within themselves, while at the same time going for worldly things that are inherently impermanent and problematic. Yeah? So there you are, simile of the borrowed goods. Next simile here. This is the simile of the jungle or the forest. Yeah, and the Buddha says, imagine two people living in a village or living in a town, and they go down into the forest. Yeah, when they go down into the forest, the first of these people, he walks into the forest and he looks around. Yeah, the forest is very dark. The forest is very thick and dense, and he can't see very far in any direction at all. But he's wandering around in his forest, looking for things that will make him happy. Then he comes to a mango tree. Yeah, mango tree. Wow, mango tree. Ripe mangoes on the tree. He climbs up the mango tree, and he goes up in the mango tree, and he sits there, and he eats mangoes. Yeah, and while he eats mangoes, because mangoes are so delicious. Is anyone here who doesn't like mangoes? Everybody likes a nice ripe mango. Yeah, when they are nice. Maybe not everyone. Maybe if there's always someone who is kind of different. But most people like ripe mangoes. He goes up into the tree, indulging in ripe mangoes. And because he is indulging, he loses his mindfulness. No idea what's going on. Oh, mango is so nice. And he sits there just kind of intoxicated by mangoes. Mango intoxication. Then comes another man. You think alcohol is bad. Maybe mango is even worse, yeah, in some ways. So then another man comes along, and he does not know how to climb a tree. So he thinks, ah, all those nice mangoes, how am I going to get hold of them? Okay, takes out his axe, yeah, and starts chopping down the tree at the root. Yeah, and then the Buddha says, well, if that man who is already up in that mango tree, if he doesn't come down quickly, what's going to happen? Well, he's going to fall down, he's going to break a leg and an arm, or he might even die if it's high enough. That's what's going to happen. Yeah? So this is the problem. And what is the point of this? The point of this is that these two men, or these two people, who walk into the jungle, walk into the forest. The jungle here, as I read it, is a simile for the sensual world. Yeah? We are in the sensual world. Maybe we are in the city. When you are in the city, there's all kind of sensual pleasures available for you. There's cafes. There is entertainment going on. That's where you find your kind of partner for life and all of these kind of things. Yeah, cities are a place of sensuality. It's like walking around in the city, yeah, looking at all of these nice potential sensual pleasures. Walking around in the jungle. But of course, just like the city, the jungle is a place where you can't see very far. Yeah, that's when you are in the realm of sensual pleasures, your mind is limited. Your mind is not vast and expansive as it can be in meditation practice. It's limited and contracted. Yeah, you can't see very far away. You have no overview. You have no bird's eye view. You have no perspective on what is going on. That is the problem with being in the jungle. All you're doing is looking for the next sensual pleasure. Yeah, this is like life is a bit like that. Looking for the next pleasure. Looking for the next happiness. Looking for what we can do next. Where are we going to go on holiday? Which restaurant are we going to go to tonight? What are we going to do? Always thinking of some more pleasure down the road. And as you indulge in those pleasures, as you indulge in this happiness of the senses, then because you are indulging, because you are intoxicated, you're losing your mindfulness. And before you know it, it is your turn to die. Yeah, before you know it, you are, I don't know, 75, 80, 85, I don't know when people die these days, various ages. And that's it. You had it. You're finished. And because you were intoxicated on the way, because you were indulging too much on the way, you lost your mindfulness. You lost your ability to think clearly about what is really important in life. And then death surprises you when it finally happens. And of course, you're not ready to die when that happens. Yeah, you got intoxicated because you were intoxicated. You forgot that living well is important. You forgot that kindness and compassion and peace in life actually is so significant to make us really happy in a deeper sense and for practicing the spiritual path. You forgot all of that. And then when you die in a bad way, wondering what you did. So what is the alternative? And the alternative is this, and this is another nice little simile from the suttas, the simile of two friends walking through the jungle, walking through this dense jungle of sensuality, not really seeing very far ahead or any direction at all. Then they come to a hill, a tall hill, almost like a mountain. And then one friend says to the other one, let's go to the top of the hill, top of the mountain. The other one says, no, I'm not interested. I will stay down here at the bottom. So his friend said, okay, I will go up by myself. So he goes up to the top of the mountain. And when he gets up to the top of the mountain, he says, wow, you should see, when you stand on the top of the mountain, you can see fields, you can see villages, you can see roads, you can see all of these things, lakes and gardens and groves, all this kind of stuff. So he shouts down to his friend, yay, I can see all this stuff from the top here. And his friend says, no way, absolutely no chance you can see that from the top of the mountain. And the friend on top gets a bit exasperated because he can see all of these things, yeah? So he goes down to the bottom of the mountain, grabs his friend by the arm, yeah? Not using too much violence because he's a good Buddhist, but a little bit, yeah? Okay, come along. Drags him up to the top of the mountain. You get super strength when it's something important to show other people. Drags him all the way up and says, look, okay, what do you see? Oh, yeah, I see fields, yeah, gardens, groves, villages, roads, all these things. Well, why did you say, you know, at the bottom of the mountain that you didn't see that? And the friend replies, because when I was at the bottom, I was obstructed by this very mountain from being able to see those things. And the point here is that when you are in the midst of sensuality, when you are in the midst of the sensual objects of the world, you have no perspective. You have no overview. You are like a fish in water. All you know is water. You have no idea about anything else. And it's impossible for you to understand sensuality. When you practice the spiritual path, you elevate yourself gradually, lifting yourself out of sensuality until one day you reach a state of samadhi. And when you reach the state of samadhi, for the first time, have you extracted yourself from the world of sensuality? For the very first time, do you have the eagles, the bird's eye view, and you can actually see what is going on? Yeah? Then you understand sensuality. Then you know the problem of these things. This is the opposite of as being in the jungle, being in the forest, then you know the problem, then you know what is going on. Most of the time, we are just intoxicated, following along. And for this reason, sometimes we need to have a little bit of faith and confidence in the teachings of the Buddha, in the promise of what meditation actually can do for us. So what is that promise? Well, this is where the very last simile, actually a couple of more similes, perhaps see what happens. I've only got a few more minutes, otherwise I'm going to be over time. The very last simile that I want to talk about tonight, and this is the simile of the dog. The simile of the dog is the dog which is hungry. Yeah, if you've seen some of these dogs in India, they're always hungry, always looking for food. They're not like the pampered dogs in the West. Yeah, with dogs, we look after them. Yeah, they're really kind of happy. In India, they're kind of really scrawny and kind of terrible and terrified of human beings for kicking them and all this kind of stuff. So these dogs in India, they are running around, yeah, from one butcher shop to the next one. And whenever they come to a butcher shop, the butcher is not going to give them any meat. You don't give valuable meat to a kind of, you know, scrawny, dodgy dog coming around every now and again. But the butcher, because he has a little bit of compassion, when all the meat has been taken off the bone, he chucks the bone out to the dog. Yeah? And of course, this bone which has no meat on it, all it has is a bit of blood. Yeah? The dog kind of ignores this bone, and all it gets is a taste of blood. All it does is increasing its craving for some real meat, for some real sustenance. Yeah, more craving. So as soon as the dog kind of has finished licking off the blood of that bone, it runs off to the next butcher shop. Yeah, still craving, still desiring, trying to get something else. It goes to the next butcher shop. Same thing happens again. No meat, no sustenance, nothing of that fulfills you inside. Again, the same kind of craving by licking the blood and not really getting anything else. And on it goes, from butcher shop to butcher shop, from household to household, life after life, eon after eon. This is the simile of human beings, the simile of always running after sensual pleasures, never giving any real satisfaction, never giving any sense of fulfillment and completion, never being a real goal, a real purpose in life, never actually getting you anywhere. You're always just keeping on doing the same thing again and again and again. This is the real problem of craving for sensual pleasures. There is no finality to it. There is no goal. There is nowhere we're going. We're just doing the same thing again and again and again. This is a simile of the dog. Yeah. So what is the alternative? And this is where the Buddhist path comes in. The Buddha says there is an alternative happiness, a happiness that leads to real fulfillment, real completion, that actually is a real end in its own right. What is that happiness? It starts off by practicing kindness and generosity and compassion in this world. And as you do that, I would really recommend each one of you to think about this very carefully. When you do an act of kindness, when you do an act of generosity, how do you feel about yourself? Yeah, and I'm sure you will have noticed, yeah, that when you do an act of kindness, when it really comes from your heart, you feel good about yourself. How does that feel? And you will also notice it's a very different kind of feeling from the feeling of satisfaction that you get from craving. When you crave, that satisfaction you get is kind of hollow and empty. And you crave while you're doing it, and then the craving soon re-arises again. It's a very hollow kind of satisfaction you get there. But the happiness that you get through living well, through doing the right thing, is a satisfaction happiness that has no craving coming with it. There's no craving there. It is a happiness that is in the present moment. And because of that, it is a peaceful and beautiful kind of happiness. This is already, just by living well, just by living with kindness, by living with care, and living with honesty, and doing the right things in the world. And as you keep on doing this, you get into meditation, you come here to Dhammaloka Center on Fridays, maybe you come to the Saturday meditation, maybe you start coming to Jhana Grove, yeah, doing some retreats or whatever, and as you do that, you are deepening your meditation gradually, gradually over time. And as your meditation gets deeper, that happiness that you started getting just by living in a kind way gets more and more internalized, more and more. You find this through your meditation practice, just by sitting inside of yourself, being inside of yourself, finding that true refuge within. The happiness, the joy becomes more and more powerful, more and more in the present moment, more and more unified, until one day you reach a full state of samadhi, a full state, a deep state of meditation practice. And when you do that, one day, you realize that you have found a complete sense of satisfaction, a complete sense of fulfillment. There is no further goal. There's nowhere else to go. Before, you were always driven by craving, driven by desires. The craving always promising you satisfaction. Yeah, if you think about it, whenever you think about a relationship or think about any sensual objects in the world, there's always a promise of satisfaction there. But it doesn't last. And even when you have it, it's not all that interesting. Craving is still there. But here, for the first time in your life, you find absolute satisfaction. Craving is completely gone. There is no desire anymore. There's no drive to go anywhere else. So what is that? Well, what that is, and this is why it is so profound. What you have found the answer to the very meaning, the question of the meaning of life. The moment there is no more drive anymore, there's no more will, there's no more craving, there's no more to go. Yeah, you have found something where you find complete contentment and satisfaction. The hole inside has been filled up. There's no more itch there. All that is gone. Complete satisfaction. That is the answer to the question of the meaning of life. You have discovered the very meaning of life itself. This is what the Buddhist path promises. And this is why it is so extraordinarily exceptional and profound. It really gives you the answer to the meaning of life. And I think that if we can just grasp that and get that, then from that comes that commitment and perseverance to the Buddhist path, because you understand there's nothing else to look for. This is it. This is what life actually is all about. Of course, you may get into that state of samadhi, and then you may lose it again afterwards. And that is where the idea of insight comes, yeah? The final analysis, it is the insight, the understanding that kind of breaks this whole process and makes craving stop once and for all. And that is where you find the final meaning of life through the Buddhist practice. And this is what this all is leading us towards that very sense of finding the meaning of life. But to do that, in the process, you also gradually abandon all the sensual objects, all the sensual desires in this world, you gradually abandon them until one day you actually reach this. And then you understand what life really is about. You understand the purpose of all of this, and you understand why it was necessary on that path to abandon these things. So please don't go back home and think that you're going to abandon all sensuality in one go. Yeah, chuck out all the nice things in your life. Don't do that. Just reflect on these things. Reflect on them. Think about them. See if they make sense to you. Internalize them so they become your wisdom rather than the Buddha's wisdom or someone else's wisdom. And as you internalize these things, gradually your life will start to go down a different path all by itself. And you will start to feel more satisfied. You will start to find more meaning in life. And everything becomes much more profound as a consequence. Okay, that is all for tonight. Okay, would anyone, thank you very much, would anyone like to ask any questions or comment or anything like that?
Yeah, Ajahn, I mean, like, the sutta's about stream winners enjoying sensual pleasures, and yeah, I just, you know, I wonder about our chances.
Well, it's a long path, yeah. And even though you have full insight into reality, you know, if you are a streamer, especially if you are a layperson, the reality is you often you don't have time to do any meditation practice. And when you don't have time, you're going to seek for happiness somewhere else. So you seek for that happiness again in sensuality. So it's natural. But the mind of a stream mentor will incline towards meditation. You always want to go back to that. And your indulgence will be very kind of basic, will be at a very low level compared to the indulgence of vast majority of people. So don't worry about the chances you have. It's not really about the chances. What it's about is whether you're going in the right direction. As long as you're going in the right direction, as long as you see a change in your life, if you keep on going, eventually you have to get there. As long as the change kind of keeps on going, eventually you're going to have to reach whatever goal it is that you aspire for. Okay, anyone else? Yeah, please don't be shy. If you have never asked a question before, this is the chance. Yeah, first time, it's always a good... Everybody happy? Yeah, everybody, nobody wants to ask questions? Okay. Good. So, I don't know if that means you are entirely convinced or you are utterly skeptical, but it doesn't really matter. So, let's just take a few questions from overseas then. There's three questions from overseas. The first one is from Wolfram from Germany. And he asks, are you free to enjoy everything as long as you are not attached to it? Just letting go of desires be a natural and gradual loss of interest and not by denial and suppression of joy. I would say that you should enjoy life. This is, I think, an important thing. The idea that it is possible to live life without enjoyment and just kind of, you know, have no joy and kind of enter all the happiness of the path. I think that is impossible. So make sure that you enjoy the ordinary happinesses of life and let it be a gradual movement, the gradual reduction of the happiness coming from sensuality and a gradual increase in the happiness coming from practicing the path. That is really the ideal way, so you don't feel that you are deprived of happiness and joy in your life. At the same time, the idea that you are going to enjoy it without being attached to it, that's really impossible. Yeah, you are going to attach to it. You have no choice. Attachment is a natural expression of the ego. If you have an ego, unless you are a stream mentor, arahant again, you're going to attach to things. That's what the ego does. That's one of the aspects of ego. So don't worry about it so much if you are attached. A little bit of attachment is going to be there. Move your attachment towards things that are more worthy of attachment. Attach a little bit to your precepts, to your kindness, to compassion, to all of these positive things. And if you attach it more to the positive things, you can let go of attachment a little bit to the bad things. Yeah, I'm saying bad, to things that are not as lofty and so noble. And gradually, as you do that, you are kind of moving, kind of climbing up the ladder, if you like, reaching for a higher rung, attaching to a higher rung, letting go of the lower rungs, yeah? Attaching to higher things. And as you do that, your attachment actually becomes lighter as you move up the ladder. Attachment to sensual pleasures are very hard and sticky. The higher up you go, the lighter it becomes. And eventually, all attachment is gone. So that's okay. So don't worry too much. But if there's a bit of attachment there, rather try to move to higher kinds of attachment and let go of the lower ones. And don't force the path. I think one of the things that is so important on the Buddhist path is to enjoy it, to make sure that it is delightful and enjoyable. And if you do that, you're going to end up on this Buddhist path for a long, long, long time. If you make it miserable, if you make it too hard, too difficult for yourself, there's no way you're going to be able to sustain it in the long run. So please do that. And then hopefully you will be around for a long time. Anyway, nice to hear from you, Wolfram. Number two. This is from Hadil from Israel. How can we overcome the physical craving to someone we are romantically in love with? Probably cannot, yeah, this is the problem. It's probably can't do that. So don't worry too much about it. Practice the path to the best of your ability without trying to overcome those things. It's, you know, if you are in a romantic relationship, well, that's, you know, the reason why you're there is partly because of that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in that romantic relationship, probably. So it's kind of part of the deal when you are there. So just think about these similes, practice the path and see where it leads you. Who knows where it's going to lead you in the future. But you cannot really overcome that craving while you are in a romantic relationship. So just practice. See what happens. And maybe down the track something will happen and maybe things will change. But in the meantime, just take that as part of the deal when you are into that kind of relationship. Number three, this is Evie from the USA. Can attachment to wholesome things, such as a spiritual practice, also have the potential to become a form of sensual pleasure if approached in the wrong way? It can never be a sensual pleasure because attachment to spiritual practice is not sensual. It's a different kind of attachment. And as I just said, I think a little bit of attachment to your spiritual practice actually is a very good thing, because if you have no attachments to your precepts, what's going to happen? You're not going to keep them, basically. That's what it is. Because there's always going to be some desire that wants to override the precepts. Yeah. So if you have no attachment, you just shrug your shoulders. Oh, yeah, whatever. And just do whatever you want to do. So a little bit of attachment, a little bit of commitment, maybe isn't a better word of putting it, a bit of commitment to those precepts is actually quite important. Otherwise, you're never really going to get there. So generally speaking, I would say a little bit of attachment to the Buddhist path is good. Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm proud of being a Buddhist myself, and I certainly have some attachment to that path. Otherwise, I wouldn't be a monk anymore. I would be doing all kind of other stuff instead. So a little bit of attachment is good, but not too much attachment, not wrong kind of attachment, not attachment that leads you to arguing, for example, a lot with other people. Yeah, I believe in rebirth. What, you fool, believing in rebirth? No, rebirth is true. Yeah, and that kind of stuff. And when you get into that sort of thing, it becomes problematic. And also be careful where your attachment is. Don't attach too much to individuals. This is one, I think, of the great dangers on the spiritual path. You see that everywhere around the world in spiritual matters. People attaching to gurus, people attaching to teachers, yeah? And that can lead to lots of problems. It can lead to abuse. It can also lead to a lot of distress if that person decides to disrobe, for example, yeah? You are attached to someone, you think, yeah, they're an arahant. I've seen this so many times. It is so hard as a layperson to know who's an arahant. Yeah, you project onto people. You think, yeah, this person, they're definitely an arahant. And the next day, they are married. Yeah, wait a minute, what happened? Yeah, so be very careful with that. It's very, very difficult sometimes. Some people can be very charismatic. They can be good speakers. They can have all this kind of magnetic personality or whatever, and you're drawn to them. And then just as you're drawn to them, bang, you know, they're kind of doing all kind of dodgy stuff. And that is always a very bad thing here. So attach in the right way. Attach with a sense of care. Always investigate. And as you do that, there's nothing wrong with attachment. In fact, attachment is part and parcel of having a sense of self. You can't really avoid it unless you are fully enlightened or awakened yourself. Okay, so those are my answers. Anyone else want to say anything? Everyone happy or I'm not sure what you are, but you're not asking questions anyway. So let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.